This is Susan at the Talking Information Center. It is Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. I am reading the Lynn Daily Item. EDIC sees South Harbor as largest investment in Lynn history by Daisha Smith. The EDIC board met Tuesday with an update on the transformation of South Harbor into a public park in what Executive Director James Caudill declared is the largest investment in Lynn's history. The $500 million project is now moving along in the process. City permitting is complete and the state will take over the process, which Caudill describes as lengthy. It took 10 months to acquire the first state license and they've just begun the process for the Chapter 91 license. Construction on both the infrastructure and Harbor Park is expected to begin this September, Caudill said, while the work on the building itself will likely begin next year. The state has also approved an $8 million grant program through the Mass Works for the next 3 years, a $24 million commitment to the project. Despite the current state of the economy, which could impact construction costs, Caudill is confident that the state is moving the process along. I talked to them. 100% they're going forward and they're paying for the creation of the 8-acre park and the infrastructure. Regarding the park itself, the board has asked the public for input on what they'd like to see in the recreational space, including interest in a stage for performances and swings. It has been really awesome to get the public input on that, and that's going to really guide us as far as what type of park is going to be built, Caudill said. The goal is for South Harbor to transform the waterfront and provide the Lynn community with a space that best utilizes the now vacant land. We know how important it is to the city of Lynn just to get this project off the ground, and coming across that bridge and seeing something nice in that location will be really big, Ward 6 Councilor Fred Hogan said. Obviously, there's a couple of projects we want off the ground too, but at least it's still moving forward, so we're happy with that. Board okays Bullfinch Road Plan by Brianna Alvarez. The planning board met Tuesday evening to discuss a preliminary subdivision plan regarding Bullfinch Road, ultimately voting unanimously to approve the proposal with conditions. Abutters have not yet been formally notified, as the proposal is still at the preliminary stage. Engineer Anthony Donato of Hancock Associates outlined the proposal to the board. The property currently contains an existing dwelling off Bullfinch Road. Under the plan, we're proposing a 350-foot cul-de-sac roadway, Donato said. The existing home would remain and be designated as a modified Lot 1, with 5 additional lots created. The site is located in the R1 zoning district, which requires a minimum lot size of 6,000 square feet. Donato detailed the proposed lot sizes, varying from 9,250 square feet for Lot 1, up to 39,500 square feet for Lot 6. These are large lots, he noted. Donato explained that the property slopes steeply to the east with a low point at the southern end. An existing wetland area has been flagged and will require a filing with the Conservation Commission. The project includes some filling to allow for a roadway crossing, along with proposed wetland replication. To minimize impacts, the board is proposing a 3-sided box culvert at the wetland crossing. Actually, we are proposing a box culvert over the wetland so that technically it won't be bisected or disturbed, Donato said, adding that the intent is to minimize the disturbance to the existing wetland. The development would be serviced by sewer and water connections from Bullfinch Road. Because of site grading and roadway requirements, some significant earthwork would be necessary at the eastern portion of the property. 3 waivers were identified as part of the preliminary submission, allowing Cape Cod berm and granite curb, permitting a roadway intersection angle of less than 75 degrees, and reducing the sidewalk requirement to one side of the road. Board members discussed whether similar waivers had been granted in the past. Donato noted that such waivers were approved previously on small projects such as this 6-lot subdivision. Although waivers are not required at the preliminary stage, they were included to give the board a preview of what may be requested with a definitive plan. Board members also raised concerns about the proposed retaining walls, which could reach heights of up to 25 feet. William Marr said, "One thing that I would like to see in the future is the wall design plans by a structural engineer submitted to the planning board. The plans meet the requirements of a preliminary subdivision plan, so I would recommend that it be approved, but there's no reason not to approve it," planning board liaison Michael Donovan stated. However, he cautioned that no soil testing had yet been conducted. "There's extensive excavation and blasting, but there's no soil testing done," Donato added, noting that without test pits and borings, the plan does not clearly show whether ledge cuts or retaining walls will be required. He recommended that the board require soil test pitting and borings throughout the site, particularly in areas with potential 25-foot cuts and for any stormwater infiltration systems. Chairman Robert Stillian also confirmed that the Conservation Commission approval would be required before the project could move forward. The board ultimately voted to approve the preliminary subdivision plan unanimously, subject to conditions including soil borings and test pits, submission of structural wall design plans, and all required approvals from the Conservation Commission. A definitive plan and public hearing will follow if the approval is granted. Marblehead Keys on Immigration by Sophia Harris. A standing room crowd filled Old North Church for a community forum on immigration enforcement, legal pathways, and the concrete ways local residents can support immigrant families. The panel brought together two veteran Marblehead immigration attorneys, Nancy Norman of Horrigan and Norman and Diane Slavitt, alongside Dr. Alexandra Pinneros Shields, a Brandeis University professor and longtime Essex County community organizer. Senior Minister Reverend Lindsay Popperson opened the evening by naming what many attendees were feeling: worry, uncertainty, and isolation. "There are times when we can feel really alone and like we're the only ones who feel the way we feel," she told the audience. The turnout of approximately 80 people, she said, was a reminder that concern is shared and that community conversations like this are necessary. The discussion focused on two intertwined questions: what has changed in immigration enforcement and what ordinary people can do locally and practically to help immigrant neighbors stay safe, stable, and connected. Attorney Slavitt, who represents asylum seekers, families, and work permit applicants, began with a blunt assessment of what she described as a shifting enforcement climate, one in which people with pending applications and no criminal history can still become targets. Slavitt's practice includes pro bono advocacy for unaccompanied children, as well as service through the Essex County Probate Court Lawyer of the Day program. She told the audience her work now feels like it has expanded beyond guiding clients through procedures. "As an immigration attorney, my role has always been to just get my clients through the immigration process," she said. "But now I feel like I have a second role, to defend my clients." In her remarks, Slavitt described the fear created when rules appear to shift mid-process, especially for people pursuing lawful avenues such as asylum or humanitarian relief. She also focused on the growing pressures faced by unaccompanied minors, including obstacles that can discourage sponsors from stepping forward to care for children in federal custody. Attorney Nancy Norman followed with a practical roadmap of how immigration lawyers evaluate cases and identify available options, especially in an increasingly restrictive environment. Norman has dedicated her career exclusively to immigration law with nearly 40 years of experience and is widely regarded as one of Massachusetts' most seasoned removal defense experts. Other attorneys, she noted, regularly refer their most complex cases to her, particularly those involving deportation defense matters that unfold in U.S. immigration court. Norman emphasized that immigration law is highly individualized. The details of a person's entry history, family ties, work history, victimization, and any previous interaction with the immigration system can completely change what relief is possible. Attorney Norman stated, attorneys keep fighting case by case, nonprofit networks collaborate, and federal court strategies can sometimes be used to challenge unlawful detention. But, she said, the law alone cannot carry the burden. Community support is part of what makes legal defense possible in practice. Dr. Alexandra Pinero Shields widened the frame, connecting today's enforcement climate to longer historical trends and to the civic choices communities make. Pinero Shields is an associate professor of the public policy program at the Heller School at Brandeis University. Her work focuses on immigration policy, economic justice, and community-based research. Pinero Shields began with a personal story about her family's experience emigrating through a U.S. embassy, a pathway that felt strikingly different, she said, from what immigrant families face today. She offered a historical snapshot across the 20th and 21st centuries. Federal immigration responsibilities shifted from being housed within agencies focused on labor to justice and eventually homeland security. The bureaucratic arc, she argued, reflects how immigrants have increasingly been framed as threats rather than contributors. A major theme of the night was that people often want to help but don't know where to start. The panel answered that meaningful action doesn't require expertise, just commitment, coordination, and attention to what's happening locally. Among the strategies discussed was supporting legal defense funds and nonprofit legal organizations, especially because immigrants in civil immigration proceedings do not have a guaranteed right to counsel, as well as contributing to mutual aid funds that help families cover essentials when work authorization is delayed or legal options are limited. Also participate in court accompaniment programs where trained volunteers attend hearings to provide support and observe interactions when immigration enforcement is reported near courthouses. Another strategy is neighborhood-level solidarity, including phone trees and rapid communication networks, so families are not isolated if enforcement activity is reported. Throughout the evening, the panel returned to one underlying point. Immigration issues may be debated nationally, but their impacts are felt street by street at workplaces, schools, court buildings, and family dinner tables. And the response, the speakers insisted, can also be local. The forum did not offer easy answers. What it offered instead was a clearer picture of what immigrant families are facing and a set of practical entry points for residents who want to help. If the goal is to counter fear with stability, the panelists suggested, then belonging isn't a slogan. It's something communities build through legal defense, mutual aid, and policies that help keep neighbors connected rather than exposed. As Popperson said in her welcome, the gathering itself was proof that people are not alone. The panel's message went one step further. Concern is important, but it becomes protective only when it turns into organized action. Saugus Library Shifts into Action Plan by Elizabeth Della Piana. With the strategic plan accepted by the Mass Board of Library Commissioners, the Saugus Public Library has moved to the first action plan. The action plan outlines what the library will do over the next 6 months, beginning January 1st. Director Alan Tybalt noted that these were all items he wanted to complete before the end of June, and that at the June meeting he'd have an action plan for the second half of the calendar year, which would be the first half of fiscal year 27. In terms of advocating for additional full-time and part-time staff hours, particularly in children's and technical services, we're going to have to conduct a benchmark study to help set our target staffing and compensation levels, he said. Tybalt plans to get that benchmark study done by the end of June. The library will also be determining possible staff attrition over the next 3 years. I'm also going to do a project on projected demographic changes to help us determine future service demands, he said. The library will also be working to identify new programs for underserved populations and plans to solicit program ideas from the entire staff. Also part of the plan is investing in technology and digital infrastructure. We're going to replace 2 staff and 2 public PCs. We've already replaced the reference staff and tech services staff printers. We want to increase the performance of our Wi-Fi and public printing, he said. He noted that the library would be looking to identify a potential new Wi-Fi vendor. The plan also involves optimizing library spaces for comfort, learning, and connection by increasing quiet study, meeting, and collaborative spaces. We're going to obtain some quotes for study pods, those telephone booth-like things that people can use, and plan distribution of the study pods, he said. They'll also be working to empower and invest in the library staff and provide training on working relationships and working with patrons with special needs. And we'll be including staff in policy revisions and creation. We're already seeking staff input in all policy and revision creation. We'll continue to do that, he said. Board Chair Michael Sullivan thanked Thibault for his work, stating that it was great progress. Healy Ayotte, Drawn to Immigration Competitiveness Debates, by Sam Drysdale of the State House News Service. From taxes to ICE detention, Governors Mara Healy and Kelly Ayotte are trading cross-border barbs and turning each other into convenient political foils in an election year. The latest flare-up between the Massachusetts Democrat and the New Hampshire Republican spans affordability, out-migration, taxes, and a proposed 400-bed Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention facility in Merrimack, New Hampshire, about 20 miles north of the Massachusetts border. Appearing Sunday on WCVB-TV's On the Record program, Healy called for Ayotte to oppose the proposed detention facility in the Granite State. When asked about the proposed ICE detention facility in Merrimack, Healy did not mince words. Absolutely not. That's crazy. The proposal is part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Detention Reengineering Initiative, a plan to expand immigrant detention capacity nationwide. Documents released this week by Ayotte's office outline a network of new, large-scale detention centers and processing sites intended to serve as ICE long-term detention solution and to support mass deportations. In Merrimack, ICE proposes retrofitting a roughly 325,000 square foot vacant warehouse at 50 Robert Milligan Parkway into a regional processing center with 400 to 600 beds. The agency said it would spend $158 million on renovations and $156 million to operate the site for its first 3 years, according to the documents. ICE has described the initiative as a new detention model that aims to meet the growing demand for bed space and streamline the detention and removal process. The document said these facilities will ensure the safe and humane civil detention of aliens in ICE custody while helping ICE effectuate mass deportations. Healy, who grew up in New Hampshire, on Friday called the project outrageous and absolutely the wrong move for New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and our entire region. She added, Governor Ayotte needs to stand up and oppose this and say no. Ayotte told the New Hampshire Journal, New England is in this position because Governor Healy and Massachusetts created a billion-dollar illegal immigrant crisis in our region. Get your own house in order, Mara. In a subsequent statement, Healy said, we should be opposing ICE's tactics, not allowing them to expand. I oppose this in the strongest possible terms, and I am demanding that Governor Ayotte do everything in her power to block a new ICE facility in southern New Hampshire. During Sunday's appearance on the Record, Healy also called for the federal government to defund ICE. ICE right now is not acting like a law enforcement agency. They're out there with rogue tactics, she said, adding that ICE right now has more funding than all state and local law enforcement around the country combined. Navs Seeking Host Families by Joshua Cummins. The North Shore Navigators are seeking host families for the 2026 season. To continue bringing in talented players from all over the country, the Navigators are looking to add to their dedicated group of host families. Every summer, local families generously provide homes away from home for Navigators players. The hosting experience and housing arrangement proves beneficial and rewarding for both the hospitable families and the players, with many long-lasting relationships formed. Without the support of the host family network, Navigators Baseball simply wouldn't be possible. Requirements are bed, laundry, facilities, a parking spot if needed, and help with meals. Players are fed before and after games. Each host family will receive a lifetime pass for each family member, a team photo in season, a host family t-shirt for each family member, an invitation to selected Navigators special events, free registration to the Navigators Future Prospect Summer Camp for children, host family and team parent weekend festivities, on-field recognition at Nav's last home game with their player, and a lifetime of memories. Interested in hosting a player this summer? Reach out to Derek January at dj@nsnavs.com for more information. Matthews looks like leader the U.S. expected, by Stephen Wino from the Associated Press in Milan. The spotlight is constantly on Austin Matthews, no matter where he is. He carries a lot on his shoulders in the NHL as captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs in what is known as the center of the hockey universe. He also has tons of pressure wearing the C for the U.S. at the Milan Cortina Olympics. By the time the preliminary round ended, Matthews looked precisely like the leader the Americans were hoping he would be. He scored 2 goals and had an assist on an otherworldly pass in a performance against Germany that coach Mike Sullivan called inspiring to the whole group. Teammates are quick to defend Matthews, the captain, and the player, with his style being far more about leading by example than with words. He's a quiet leader, but he does things the right way, center Dylan Larkin said Tuesday. He sacrifices offense by being on the defensive side of the puck all the time. He blocks shots, and then he rises to the occasion. There's no one better to lead our group than him. Matthews leads the U.S. into the quarterfinals against Sweden or Latvia, tied for first on the team in scoring with 5 points. The Germany game stood out because, by his standards, the 28-year-old center had a quiet start in Milan. He's been great all tournament, linemate Jake Gwensel said. You guys put a lot of heat on him for no reason. He's just an unbelievable player and plays in all situations. Jack Eichel is the first-line center between brothers Brady and Matthew Tkachuk, but Sullivan loves what the trio of Matthews, Gwensel, and Baldy can provide for his team. Matthews, as a second-line center, is an incredible luxury reserved only for tournaments like the Olympics, when the collection of elite talent is this deep. The way he plays the whole game defensively, winning face-offs, he's great down low, and he's always in the right place, Baldy said. The way he's able to score and the way he's able to play such an honest game is pretty remarkable. Matthews led the NHL in goals 3 times in his first 9 seasons and is not far removed from scoring 69 in 2023-2024. That's not what the players and coaches around him are talking about when they see what Matthews is doing on the ice. He does a lot of things really well, even when he's not producing, that people might not notice, defenseman Zach Werenski said. Everyone's always focused on his goal scoring, and rightfully so. He's one of the best goal scorers in the world. But since we've been here, he's been such a leader for us, the way he plays the game. General manager Bill Guerin, who put this team together and decided to keep Matthews as captain, just like at the Four Nations face-off a year ago, pointed that out before the tournament started. Guerin said he has a great relationship with Matthews, who he called a pretty special kid. I think the world of him, Guerin said. There are a lot of different ways to lead. He's not a man of many words, but he puts it out there every night. Against Germany, Matthews' feed to Werenski and goal from the edge of the crease made it clear he was rounding into all-star form. Sullivan thinks Matthews' game has been building since group play started, and Matthews agrees. Each game, I felt better and better, he said. It's nice to kind of get rewarded like that and just continue to build your confidence individually and as a team. Matthews does not seem to lack confidence as a player, and being in the pressure cooker that is Toronto has only hardened the Arizona native for this experience. I'm sure he's different here than with Toronto, just because it's such an elite group forward, Jack Hughes said. He is a guy we look up to drive our group. Mass single-family home sales dropped 13%. median price climbs to $612,500 by Colin Young of the State House News Service. There were 2,305 single-family homes sold across Massachusetts last month, almost 13% fewer than were sold a year earlier, as analysts point to a holiday season slowdown among prospective buyers. The Warren Group reported Tuesday that January sales represented a decline of 12.7% compared to January 2025. But with the number of sales down, the median single-family home price continued to climb. Last month, up 4.7% over last January to hit $612,500. Cassidy Norton, associate publisher of the Warren Group, said homes that closed in January went under agreement in November or December, a time when the holidays generally mean fewer active house hunters. The lack of inventory also contributed to a drop in sales and an increase in price. The dynamic of chronically limited inventory and always escalating prices has played a major role in driving up cost of living in Massachusetts. State policymakers are counting on a new housing production law to begin to chip away as what is expected to be a 220,000-plus housing unit shortage by 2030. Governor Healey said in December that the state has so far started or built 100,000 homes and touted her administration's release of 450 acres of surplus state land to be developed into thousands of new homes. Worcester reported more single-family home sales last month than any other municipality, with 53. Next up on the list was Plymouth with 31 closed sales. Falmouth and Chicopee were tied with 26, followed by 25 sales in Brockton and Pittsfield each, and 24 sales each in Wareham and New Bedford. By comparison, there were 5 single-family homes sold in Boston last month. Celebrating Artistic Excellence at Bishop Fenwick by Elizabeth Della Piana. Bishop Fenwick High School has announced that 7 students and 8 projects are being recognized in the 2026 Scholastic Art and Writing Awards. The Scholastic Art and Writing Awards have celebrated bold, innovative thinking in young artists across the country since 1923. Nearly 9,000 art entries were submitted this year from across Massachusetts. Local winners included Gold Key awardee Danielle Nalesnick of Revere, Silver Key winner Neve Bachman of Beverly, honorable mentions Luis Mendoza of Peabody, Sophia DeLuca of Peabody, Violet White of Salem, and Molly Ingersoll of Lynn, an additional Silver Key winner, Kaylin Gracia of Beverly. Thanks were also given to visual arts teachers Taryn Beatrice and Sierra O'Flynn Gillis.